Perket. Mishnat Shalosh, the Malchut Belshazzar, HaMelech, and we're back to Hebrew. It was the third year of Malchut Belshazzar. Well, the third year of Malchut Belshazzar was the end of Belshazzar. So in other words, he is basically now at the very edges of the transition from Bavel into Modai. And therefore, he's not even in Bavel anymore in his mind. Chazon nira elai ani Daniel, acharei nira elai betechila. And note the elai ani Daniel. The elai ani Daniel seems very repetitive. Unless the point is that it's connected to considering what it is that it was shown to be initially, which had nothing to do with me. I was a carrier of a vision that disturbed me. It didn't seem to have any kind of relevance to the immediate future or to anything that I could understand about Klal Yisrael. This vision was shown to me, personally, Daniel, so that it would address those feelings that I had. So then, the Mefarshim asked, what's really the difference? And come up with all kinds of differences that, to some extent, I believe misses the mark, because the difference is that. The difference is I need to know how it is that this impacts upon me, and therefore, by definition, it's local. So some of the Mefarshim, as a matter of fact, the majority of the Mefarshim learned that what distinguishes this parak is its concentration on the second and third stages of the vision that before we only concentrated on the first and the fourth. Like the big impact was Rome, or whatever that fourth stage was, and it was the end of the lion stage, when that, of course, he was living through, so that to him was something that he concentrated on. But we never really, we just spoke in passing about the second and third. That is true, but it's still subsidiary to the overall issue that those are the things that are going to be the local transitions. And here we're taking a look at it from that point of view, and therefore the entire metaphor changes. According to many of the other Mefarshim, although not the majority, but including Rashi and Ramban, the things that we see here are inclusive, really, even of the fourth Chayim, but are spoken about in terms of Yisrael. Well, that's closer to what seems to be the simple meaning of the verses. Ve'er chazon, and so I see this vision. Ve'yibir oti, and as I see it, v'ani b'shushana b'ira, which implies that he wasn't really in Shushana b'ira, which makes sense, because, someone has said, well, Baal wants to say, this must be why Belshazzar didn't have access to Daniel at the night of the writing on the wall, because he wasn't in Bavel, he was in Shushan. Problem is, if he was in Shushan, how'd Belshazzar get him there with some kind of magic carpet? There's no way he could have gotten there the same night if he was in Shushan. Okay, so here he is, and he is b'Shushan habira, asher be'elam habedina. It's therefore obvious to him that he's looking into the future. Because Shushan, first of all, was not the Bira at that time. It was only going to become the Bira after the Persians made it the Bira. Even Daryavish continued to rule. Daryavish I continued to rule in Bavel, which is what they were saying to him. You're not changing anything, you're not doing anything. This became, now Shushan was the Brasilia of those days, in which, or Washington, the earlier times, let's make a world capital. That's a whole new idea. It didn't really exist. And it's Be'elam Hamedina. Ve'er chazon, I'm looking in this vision. V'ani ayiti al uval ulai. And I was on the banks. Uval, most learn uval means Loshnav Yuval. That's a flowing waters. Says the, this is Ripsad Yigal, and that's a little bit of a problem, since Shushan isn't near flowing waters. So how could he be in Shushan if you're on flowing waters?
He was misinformed.
But what's
right?
He was misinformed. Rav Sadia Gaon was misinformed. Because even though he was living there locally, what's interesting is that the Shushan that he knew, Susa, that he knew was a number of miles away from the archaeological Shushan, which indeed was found to be on water. So it was Shushan Alamer. And therefore, when he says it was on Uval Ulay, he may really be in Shushan that was at that time on Uval Ulay originally. Okay, so the other Uval could be a Lashon of Evel Hashitim. Evel means a plain. Maybe it means the plain of Susa. But what's interesting is that if you take a look at the way Susa was referred to in old, really old antiquity documents or letters, it's really referred to as Susa on the sea or on the river. So the Ulai is never mentioned. I mean, but Ulai maybe is a remez to the Hebrew, maybe, in the sense that it's the doubts that are growing up in his mind. Some suggest maybe the pshat is where I really was in Uval Ulai, but in my dream, I was in Shushan, which gets the river Ulai would be referred to someplace in Babel, not in Shushan, in Elam.
Well, there are bars in Babel.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But, I mean, the question is this part of the vision or is this where he really was? Well, the Ayiti. So it means I really was there? It means in my chazon, I saw myself there. Chazal definitely take this as the name of a river because it becomes, it's a medrash, it's repeated a number of places, that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears in Chutz La'aretz, to give over a Nevi'ah, so to give over a Mareh, it's always in a Mokum Tohar. So it has to be near a river. Because at least if you're a river, you're close to nature and you haven't been totally screwed up by human habitation. So there's some element of being able to get closer to the truth. Which, of course, is why people go to places like that. You want to get away from it all. And that's what he says. He sees himself in a mirror. Okay, I'm on vacation on the Uval Ulai.
Is this what Daniel is giving over? Is this
no, we spoke about this. You said you've been here. There are some Rishonim who say maybe it's a Darga of Nevi'ut, whatever that's supposed to mean. It's clearly, as the Gemara says, they're Nevi'im who ain't no Navi, not those who saw. So it means it did not have a din of a Navi. Is it part of Nevi'im? And the Rambam goes out of his way to say this. He himself identifies it only as Chalomot. This was what the Zohar says about Yaakov Avinu and the Parsha that's coming up. It's talking about Vinei Chalom. That's why he didn't believe it. That's why he said, Imi Elohim Imadi. Because there's a Chalom, I'm supposed to trust the Chalom. So therefore he made it into a tefillah. He didn't trust there. He wasn't really holding it by the Darga, in which there would be a sense of absolute clarity that I'm being told this by God. Fine. Again, I'd say it's really unimportant to us, I think. Because this is the way that it's become embedded in the nature of Ksuvim. We understand that we draw a tremendous amount from it. Well, and we could be Madaic and it's on itself. But while what it represents is much more metaphorical, lyrical, literature rather than inyanim that we would call Nevi'ut.
When Ramchal talks about what Nevi'ut is and how it works, he quotes some stuff from Daniel. He doesn't say that he's a Navi, but he quotes that as just what you were talking about, that you know it's certainly and it comes to you, whatever.
Yeah, okay, but again, I mean, that's what the Rambam goes out to fight to some extent. There are Rishonim that he can base that on. So.
What's the relationship between Elam, we say Elam here, and Madai and Paras?
Right. Well, at that point, Elam, which is still today, Elam really, except that now it's become separated from Kurdistan. It used to be one, which is in Iran. It used to be really one province, and that was the province that they apparently had to select it specifically to be enough in the middle of things that it would be a proper place to be able to bring everybody together. The same kind of ideas that they looked for Washington, D.C. It should be, no state should have that area. It should be given over by all the states. It's not part of Maryland. It's not part of Virginia. It borders on. But the same thing over here, that they made a province that was their, as a matter of fact, the Lushan of Bira, even though we refer to, we talk about Bira as a capital. The real meaning of Bira, we know that the Beis Hamikdash was called a Bira. Bira Asher Achinotimi. It really means a stronghold. And again, archaeologically, Shushan consists of two parts. There's the Ir Shushan, and then there's the Vayaver that Mordechai was that he crossed over Al Kamadamaya. So again, I mean, according to the Gemara, the whole idea was that there was a waterway that separated the stronghold, which was the government center, and that was more strongly protected, from the city as a whole. So when you could call a city the Bira al-Shem, that stronghold, it took on the meaning of capital. That seems to be what happened linguistically. So there he is in this new city, and he immediately understands, therefore, that he's standing in a moment of history that is post-Babel. So that he's already in the time of the Persians. And so Sainai, I lift up my eyes, Vine Ayel Echad, Omed Lifnei Uval Velo Karnai. So there's no monsters here. They're just nice herbivorous animals that you'd find on any farm, you know. And there he is. It's about the time for Bavel to be destroyed. And suddenly out of this, in front of him, in front of the water, so there's this ram, and it has karnai. It has two horns, as rams are wont to do. Ma'akarnayim gvohot, they're very large horns. Ve'achat gvohem and ashenit, one is larger than the other. But ha'gvoha ola ba'achrona, but the larger one comes second. Now this is understood to be the combination of Parasu Madai, and indeed there was that year of Daryavish before, so that the real one, the real Malchus, which is Paras, comes afterwards, but it's greater, and it shows up as being greater. And Ra'iti et ha'ayel min ha'geach yama v'tzafona v'negba, and I see this animal that it's able to gore its way in all directions. And indeed, this yama, it first goes towards the west, to which the empire extended out towards the Middle East, tzafona, v'negba, they got all the way down to Mitzrayim. This was a tremendous growth of empire. And nothing was able to stand in front of it. There was no longer any sense. And if you remember the entire period of the biblical, early biblical discussions, we have the Nevi'im Harishonim, where we had all of these wars. It was constantly getting people together to fight against. It was always these moving type of alliances in which you would band together, local kingdoms would band together to fight it. This was no longer the case. There weren't any local kingdoms. Things had switched to a sense of imperium. And that's why this is really something that's very new. This book and this experience to Daniel are new experiences. More than simply the fact that the world has changed and that the nature of Malchus is becoming more capable of integration instead of simply making temporary types of alliances just to... in which, the friend of my friend, the friend of the enemy of my friend, that type of thing. What we found now is also a deeper change, and that's the change in the status of Klal Yisrael. Because again, we take these things very much for granted because we've been through it so much. It's a given. But remember that when you had lived a millennia as a separate entity whose connection to the rest of the world was on the periphery of what the rest of the world was doing. That's not to say that you couldn't join up, that Achav wouldn't send armies all the way out to Karkamish, and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, what is happening all across the globe is only important to you at the cutting edge where it affects you. It's not that I need to be aware of the political ramifications of what is happening at each particular hour and each particular place across the globe. We exist in a time in which we take for granted that unless I have a news feed from everywhere on this planet, I'm simply not informed. But that's extremely different. Extremely different. It's a different mindset. It's a mindset that occurs very close to the final integration of Malchut, in which every schmo on the street feels, I need to know what's going on in Timbuktu. And if I don't, God only knows what's going to happen to the world if I'm not aware of what's going on in Timbuktu. But it used to be, just 50 years ago, if you wanted to say something, it wasn't Nogea, it's Timbuktu. Today, well, that's got to be part of your newsfeed. Obviously, your kids are in Timbuktu. Why not? It's a tremendous change that we take for granted. But it is so recent that for us to now try to go back in time and imagine what it is like now for the Jewish people to find themselves scattered across the globe. This is an unbelievable idea. Because what it means is that everything that happens anywhere in the world is Nogea Klal Yisrael. And this, of course, is the famous joke, the elephant of the Jewish question. This is the idea that people have of the self-centeredness of the Jews. So a kid is assigned to write an essay on elephants. And of course, she writes the elephant and the Jewish question. Right? and yet, amazingly, it's really so, in a sense. There is nothing, all of a sudden, that isn't Nogea, and that could not be the kernel of something that is desperately Nogea, to a matter of life and death, to Klal Yisrael. And that means that for the first time, the visions that we had, the earlier visions of achieving what we thought was an easily accessible goal. Shlomo HaMelech had the idea, Bikei Shlomo Liyos Mashiach, why not, you know? I mean, we've got it all, don't we? We've got our Beis HaMikdash, and we've got our army, and we've got a lot of money, and we've got boats coming in with zoos and gardens and crates. And is there more? Could there be more?
The time is right.
The time is right, exactly. And I mean, it's inconceivable. Like, what could be better? It's for all these years we're talking about. Teshuvah Shlomo HaMelech B'Shaita. You understand? I mean, now anybody has Teshuvah Shlomo HaMelech B'Shaita. I mean, in a sense. I mean, Shlomo HaMelech didn't have a refrigerator in the next room. So our concepts of what's possible, what levels of integration could be achieved, are completely changed. For Daniel, this is a fright. He's thinking about Geula is around the corner. What does Geula being around the corner mean? We'll be taken in our magic carpets back to the land of Israel, where we'll live ish tachat gafno v'tachat einato, sitting on our little farms and playing our harps. And, of course, everything will be wonderful going on in the Beit HaMikdash, and God will protect us, and the millennia will have arrived. And all of a sudden, I mean, he said, what is this? This is a shocker. So the previous parak is a shocker in the sense of that the world could be this complicated, and there's meant to be this kind of development over such long periods. It's like the shock of discovering geologic time to people that suddenly, you know, were faced with an earth that was like, you know, a billion times longer than they thought it was. And, you know, what is this? So he's utterly shocked. But now, this is in a way even more shocking, because you could dream that somehow within that big vision there was still going to be the whole magic carpet deal and it'll be okay for us. You know, it's not going to change our identity. What this parak does is it takes those things and brings it down to very human terms, which in a sense is more frightening than what happened before. Because as long as it was these wild eschatological kind of visions, I could think that that's not on a level that I have to worry about. You know, maybe it's on some kind of literary level, but it's not what I'm going to experience. But here we're talking about your local farm animals, you know. And they're also acting very out of character. I'm not used to the rams taking over the world. And here, this is what's happening. And we'll see that the things that take place are things that are going to affect Yisrael directly from this point on. And we're able to translate it, and he was meant to be able to translate it, into local history. This is next year. Bubble's going to go, and it's going to be this whole new thing in which they're going to start a whole new emperor with different visions and so on. This is a shock. V'ani ayiti mevin, and there I was, looking carefully at all of this. And as I'm watching, v'nei tzfir ha'izim ba min ha'ma'arav al pnei chol ha'aretz ve'inu geo ba'aretz. And suddenly there appears this he-goat that is coming out of the west, and it just seems to swallow everything in its path. And it doesn't even touch. It's moving so quickly that its legs don't touch the earth. And this he-goat has got this very remarkable horn between its eyes. And this, they say, the Mephor, we'll see later on, actually, the Malach is Masbir, a little bit more about what local history this is referring to. And this is the rise of Alexander. And it's interesting that the Greeks also minted coins with Alexander with a horn coming out of his forehead. Because, I mean, that whole idea of a he-goat, a horny goat, I mean, he was Pesach HaKol 20 years old at the time that he started his conquest, and he just came out of nowhere and 12 years conquered the world. It was as if he wasn't touching ground. He was moving so fast. It was simply astonishing. People had done, I mean, this was a nothing kingdom. And all of a sudden it becomes a world empire because of a kid. And the whole thing was just remarkable. So he comes up, Vayavu ad ha'ayim ba'ala karnayim, and he comes without any provocation. He just walks right up to that very powerful ram that we have been speaking about until now, which was the Persian Empire. I mean, it looked like nobody was going to be able to touch it. And he just comes right up to it. Asheraiti omed lifnei uval, the one that was standing in front of the river. Vayorot zelav b'chamat kocho, and it just rams him with the swing of its power, with the full energy, the force of its running. So it was almost as if there was, in truth, there was no provocation. It's not that Darius was looking for a fight at all. And not only that, it looked to be absolutely impossible. I mean, the historians talk about that battle, which is the Battle of Issus, that there were 600,000 Persians that was there. It's in Barnea's neighborhood, of course. And the Greeks had a maximum of 75,000 men. Not only that, the army was completely so tired from all of the... It was just not ready to fight. The Greek army. And, I mean, the Persians were absolutely not... I mean, there was nothing to fear. And all of a sudden, I mean, totally smash the Persians so that they have to regroup entirely on the other side at the already next to their own area, to the Prat and so on. That it was just, it was an astounding thing. And this was like... was this it? No, this was actually, he utilized, for the first time, he utilized a tactic of keeping a large proportion of his force in reserve and didn't commit, even though he had almost no people compared to he didn't commit them until the very end. And that changed, like, though, because one army was totally used up and now here he's got basically fresh reinforcements. I mean, there were mercenaries and so on that were attached to us, certainly. I mean, it was nowhere near what the Persians had. This was a very serious battle. I mean, the casualty figures, like 125,000 people died in the battle between the Greeks and the Persian sides, both sides, including the mercenary. And not only that, but Vera'itiv magia etzela ayo, this is very curious historically, Vayit Marmarelov, and of course this is Marmara, the Vayit Marmara, this really is that area which is called Marmara Arayon. I mean, the boat wasn't only called Marmara, but it really is. I'm just wondering if there's somehow a takeoff on. So Vayit Marmar means to fight very bitterly. And then Vayachat Ayel, Vayishaber Chtei Karnav, V'lohayakor Ba'ayel La'amod Lefanav. Now here also, he just, as I'm saying, he just kept after him. So he's Magia Eitzel Ayel. This is after Darius escaped and set up an entirely new defense force, which was already by Persian territory, made an offer to cede anything east of Nahar Prat. He would give Alexander, just leave me alone. And I was like, no, he wasn't interested in hearing terms, nothing. Just went completely shattered now. The Greeks, this is actually in what they mistakenly call Erbil. It's really Arbil or Erbil. But that's the place where Helene Amalka ended up coming from. In Monbaz, they became Jewish in later years. So the Malchus over there actually were Midgayer. And so we have the whole, we have Helene Amalka Street here. We have Monbaz, we have her remains. And so he gets there, Vayachatayel, Vayishaber Chtei Karnav. He breaks its two enormous horns, Vayakor, Vayela, Modla, Fanat. There's no strength in that ramp to stand any longer. Vayashlicheo Arza threw him to the ground, Vayir Meseo trampled over him. Lo hayam atzil ayel miyado. There was no one that could save that ayel. And indeed, what happened was that Darius just managed to escape, and apparently he was murdered by his own men, even after he miraculously got out of there. And so there was no one to be matzil, and that was the end, really, where Alexander simply took over. And Utsvira Yizimik Dil Admaod, and he was just at the height of his power, when suddenly Ucha Otsmo, as he is most powerful, Nishbra Keren Hagdolah, the great horn, which was Alexander, was broken, and nobody knows what happened. All of a sudden, he just disappeared, died. Some say it was poisoned. And nobody knows. It's not like there he was at the height of his power, and suddenly he's gone. And so because of that, instead of the Keren HaGdolah, and so in its place grew up the four kingdoms that were broken up between his brother Philip and the generals, and they were essentially split to the four directions. It really was four in the end. I mean, it's taken into consideration here the complete breakup. So that we had the four corners. The truth is that it really fits basically northeast, southwest initially. So you had the four corners of the earth, Uminachat mehem yatzak keren achat mitzira. And from one of them, one of those, the mashmut is for one of those words, came yet a small keren that branched off. But tigdal yeter al negev, and it got very overly confident, started to grow more than it deserved to, towards the south, v'al hamizrach, towards the east, v'al hatzevi, and to the most desirable of places, which calls this Eretz Yisroel, which is called Eretz Tzvi, Nachlat Tzvi, Tzivot Goyim. Tzvi means the most beautiful, the desirable. And so again, but Pashtas, although there are some of the Rishonim who try to relate this to the Romans, is very difficult because, I mean, there's no reason really to link coming out of the four Greek subdivisions to look at that as Rome, difficult to believe. What does make sense, the reason that they say this is because later on we'll see there definitely are Rumuzim. Even those that learned this entire period to be referring to the Greeks and to the Seleucid problems and Antiochus and the period of Hanukkah are made of that later on in the parak, we do suddenly skip ahead to the Churban HaBayit, that the Romans, almost everybody's made at the end. So there's a lot of mixture. And again, if we're right that the idea over here is essentially patterns and that this is not meant to be literal nevuah, it's interesting that even though we spoke about the Rambam Pshita about Daniel and the Neviut, when the Rambam describes the reaction to the Neviut among the different Neviim in Mishneh Torah, he talks about how some of the Neviim were completely broken by them, like let's say Avram Avinu, the Emach HaShecha Gedola, Nofela. So there are times that person is overwhelmed by his Neviut, and then he brings Daniel, the Pasuk of Daniel, where Daniel says, and I was terribly disturbed, and my whole face changed, and I was broken. So there's some aspect of it's almost the question of how to describe the semantics of the issue. There was what appears to be a machlokas shonim, is this nevias, this is not nevias. The question is how broadly you want to describe the nature of nevias, and like where we say nevias ends, the Ruach HaKedesh begins, and so on and so forth. So the Rambam himself was so mocked to go out of his way in the Mor Nevuchim to say, well, this is not included in what we call prophecy. Even though, again, over here, Daniel speaks, hears the words of Malachim, and they give him these broad kinds of explanations. One of the things, as the Rambam says, that most characterizes true Neviut is clarity. That there's no two ways about it. The Navi knows exactly what he's talking about. And if he doesn't understand the Neviut, then he's given to understand the Neviut. And the difference between just psychic phenomena and so on and so forth is exactly that issue. So you have all of these psychic people that we talk about as being usher to go to. It doesn't mean there isn't some maybe phenomena, but it's just completely unreliable. It doesn't really mean anything. So the question of that darga, here clearly Daniel lacks clarity according to many of the Rishonim. He himself doesn't know what's going on. He lacks clarity. Not only that he's not allowed to give over that clarity, there's a big machlokas Rishonim, whether it's true to say that he really understood the case. Didn't understand the case. The Medrash says there were two people who knew the case, but they forgot that, you know, with Yaakov and Daniel. Comparing Yaakov, again, very, very difficult to give strict definitions of how much we view this as an element of that borders on true information that's coming milamalo, or it's a much greater usage of a person's own ability to see things, and there's elements of it that come to him as Ruach HaKodesh that are beyond his keches, but that don't deserve the appellation Neviut. So here, if it's meant to be broad patterns, so then it's not so terrible. We could find the same metaphor discussing things locally. And we know that that's the main point of this parak, as opposed to the previous parak, is the concentration on the local. And that's why everything changes. Instead of the monstrosities, now we see sort of farm animals that they're used to dealing with and that are connected to Yisrael. So in that case, many of the Mepharshim explain that what this is referring to really is the Antiochus story. That's because what happened over there, Antiochus the Third took Eretz Yisrael away from the Ptolemies. From Ptolemy. Now, when that was sealed with the Cleopatra deal that he gave him, his daughter Cleopatra, and then he agreed to give back at least the money that he was making from Eretz Yisrael that he had captured from that was originally part of the Egyptian sector. Then, briefly, he agreed to pay all the taxes the money was making from Eretz Yisrael as part of the deal with Ptolemy. Then, afterwards, when Antiochus, that we call Epiphanes, Antiochus IV took over, then there, that's when all the tzaras started. First of all, he refused to pay that money, obviously. And desire to expand, continue to expand eastward, as it says over here. And became like a cancer. That's why I'm saying, Vatigdal Yeter. He just wanted too much. And that wanted too much becomes, at the end of the story over here, even an attempt to become a spiritual ruler instead of simply collecting taxes. Didn't bother anybody in Eretz Yisrael until that point. It was in the late years of his regime that we find that the whole problem of attempting to reconstruct the Aveda and the Beis HaMikdash and making Gezeiros and so on, which ultimately led to rebellion and what it did. So this would make a lot of sense that he looked to El Hatzevi. He wanted Eretz Yisrael. It's not just that he was expanding over here in these directions. He had a specific concern to want to be the king of Jerusalem. But Tigdal Ad Tzavah Shamai. And what he did was, he now attempted to actually fight Yisrael. And Yisrael referred to as the Kohavim. They are the army of heaven, so to speak. Hashem Tzvakot. That's Hashem on top of this Tzavah. The Tzavah ultimately is Klal Yisrael that represents the Reishis of Bria, which is meant to address the achievement, the ultimate achievement of humanity. And by the way, this is like the perek where the Medrash brings out that the real meaning of the questions that are asked, that are openly asked, is not a question about anything but the human condition itself. This is the first time we discuss Adam HaRishon, the nature of mortality, and why it is that the human condition is so degenerated. And that makes a great deal of sense. In other words, you think on the surface that, well, if we're only interested in local history, so like now we seem to be moving off again into the sky. But that's the point. The place in which the global becomes local is recognizing that all of this, even though to us, the rest of the world, it's very small time, and to us it appears to be very personal concerns, that the truth is that those concerns are Vatigdal Tzvah Shamayim. And it's very important for us to recognize and to understand that the things that appear to be so silly locally, the arguments and the nonsense and the level of the shmira on mitzvahs and so on, it's passing issues. But the truth is that these things are involved in the most developed aspect of humanity, even though we're not aware of its development. But the fact is it touches on the underlying nature of the story, but the deeper narrative we were talking about in the Parshas HaShavua. That is, the nature of Yisrael, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, is not something that you're going to see. I mean, that's the Bema Haftano. Like, what is there to love? You know, and Esav does it better. And why are we measuring this kind of relationship with you? We don't understand it. And we very often don't understand ourselves. And that's why it's necessary to move from what appears to be just the political to recognize that Antiochus really had ideas. He had dreams of being able to touch Yisrael. And indeed, Vatapel Artsam and Atzava, he was actually able to drop some of those upper armies. And that, of course, is the whole Hellenistic drive among the Jews, that he was able to address them and to draw them to the Greeks and to make them feel that they don't really have what to offer. Was able to take some of those stars, Umina Kochavim, but they're the same, and to crush them, to make them even like they were. And not only that, it's interesting how difficult it is for us to believe that we're Kochavim. You know? I think we don't feel like stars. I was once in Stratford in Canada, near Toronto. So I forget what it was, some kind of Shakespeare production or something. Apparently, one of the schools in Toronto, I was shocked. I came there with my kids. I was shocked. It was like rows of kids wearing yarmulkes in Stratford. They're all here. It must have been some kind of school trip. And it's like so interesting because I'm watching the contrast in a sense. And it's, to me, the only thing that really mattered in an ultimate sense was that presence of Yisrael in the room. And the thing's okay, you know, Shakespeare was interesting, but it's like it doesn't even come to touch on the same elements. I was very moved by the Yisrael aspect, not by the Shakespeare. You know. So afterwards, I shout out to them as the government, as the audience is leaving. I said, you know who the real Kochavim are, don't forget. But a powerful thing that's difficult to see, difficult to understand. And for someone who's sensitive to it, it just like It shouts out at you. And it gives an entirely different level of presence.
That tends to be viewed as a, today, anyways, as a negative thing.
No, that's the chosenness aspect. The stardom is the clarity of an identity that is meta historical, that the stupidest one of us has. Unless they're completely and totally alienated. There's just this stubborn, continued clarity about the fact that Bria did something, was meant to go somewhere, that there's a connection between humanity and God, and that's it. And we don't give in on any level. And it's the most astonishing thing, especially when you are in places that are completely without any connection to anything Jewish. You know, and everything is beautiful, and everything is perfect, and everything is totally empty. And what did Yirmiyahu say? They were able to crush them too. The Atzar HaTzava, who is the Tzar HaTzava? So someone first said, the Tzar HaTzava is Hashem Tzvakot. In other words, they turned, it became a battle against God. So that what they wanted to do was to be Mevatel, the Aveda of the Beis HaMikdash. And that's the next thing. Umimenu, Huram HaTamid, Lushlach B'chon Mikdasho. And from the impact of that guy, this Karen, they were able to prevent the continued Tamid in the Beis HaMikdash. And in the end, they actually destroyed the Beit HaMikdash itself. That's why there's so many who hold it. This is really a remnant of the Churban of the Bayit Sheni. So that the end results of this, which is interesting because in a way it is the end results. In other words, what happened ends up with that whole argument with Aristobulus and the Machlokas and the bringing in of the Romans and the Hidar Darut that ultimately really did destroy the second Beis HaMikdash. I mean, if we're putting that entire period into one sentence, you know, it makes sense. It was our heir, the Yesodus of Yisrael, so that even though there were moments of Malchus, as the Rambam puts it, that Chazra Malchus of Yisrael, but it was a Malchus that was always Mu'ur Ar. And then, Mitzavati Natena Latamin Befarsha, because of that, there was, Rashi has a very interesting understanding of the word Tzava here, as opposed to all the other Tzavas. He understands that the word Tzava means a set time, in which, like, you can't go beyond. And there is a place in Eov where it's used that way. It's just every other use of that word in this parak doesn't mean that. It means tzava. So, I mean, if it means tzava, an army, so then that ties into the Medrash in Eicha, that tzava tinatena latamid bepfasha, that it is possible for foreign armies to be able to be shaylet, even on the Avodas HaKarbonos, because of our Pesha'im. So in other words, the only time that the Malchus are able to make Gezeres of this level is where we ourselves are not what we're supposed to do. And because of that, Vatashlech Emet Arza, so that the truth and Torah was thrown to the ground, and people, this was the started with the whole period of the doubt of the veracity of Torah Shebaal Peh, and the Tzedukim, and the ongoing effects of Hellenization, and because of that, Vyasta Vitzlicha, and in everything that it did to destroy, it was Matzliach, and was able to touch things that one never would have thought were touchable. Veshme'ah echad kadosh b'dav. By the way, I'm sorry for I meant to mention that there is a completely different approach to the Tzar HaTzava, and that is that it relates to the Malachim that we find later on. Essentially, there are two sarim that are in the Shemayim that are involved in the Sefer Daniel. And one is Michael, who is viewed as the Tzar HaTzava on this level. Because remember that Daniel, the level of Daniel himself, is surprisingly din. We've seen that his concentration on the din ha'atid, on the way that din is given over to Yisrael, the din ha'yativ, and the chairs of din, not the kursaya ramyan, the vision of the ultimate success of integration being a process of din, which of course it is. There's no integration without the discrimination and the ability to bring all detail into one judgment, really. In other words, the concept of a brain that's capable of intelligence is because we view all of the varied pieces of information that are being brought into a central processing unit as the ideas of din. So as the Rambam says, it's the arifa of din that creates personality. That's why we talk about tzaddik, rosh. Without din, none of these things have any meaning. They're just They're just random events. This thing goes one direction, that thing goes in another direction. Then, because of that, the malach that relates to the Neo is Gavriel. In other words, Gavriel is the Koch HaGvura. So it's an expression of elements of Din that relate to him. Michael, on the other hand, is a reference to Yisrael as a whole. And because of that, Daniel's unable to really perceive anything in Michael. It needs to be translated to him by Gabriel. And therefore, according to some, this is already a remez here. The Sar HaTzava is a remez to the Sar of Yisrael, who were called the Tzava a minute ago. So, Vatigdala Tzava HaShavayim. So the Sar HaTzava, that's the Sar of Yisrael, who argues for Yisrael, as we'll see later on, and fights with the Sarei HaUmais. And so this Sar then could be not Kadosh Baruch Hu as Hashem Tzvakot, but rather Michael. Ve'eshma'ar echad kadosh medaber, and I hear something holy speaking. And that something holy, Vayomer echad kadosh lepalmonia medaber, that something holy says to, a palmoni is clearly ploni almoni, which is the idea of complete anonymity, that I have no tvisa over at all. If you take a look at the ploni almoni in the Targum, it's kasi vitamir, hidden and covered. So yes, that could mean in terms of human reactions, it's just anonymity. But when you're talking about echad kadosh, then it means that it cannot be named. I don't have a name for this giloy. I don't have a name for this gestalt at all. I don't understand it. And instead, I hear another gestalt speaking to this ploni hamedaber. Ad matay hachazon hatamid? How long is this supposed to go on? V'hapesha shomim teit v'kodesh v'tzava mirmaz. This pesha shomim, fascinatingly, later on, the idea of the Avodah Zorah in the Beis HaMikdash, at the time of the Romans, is called Shikutz Shomim. Pesha Shomim, many learn, is Bedafka, not a Shikutz, but it's clearly a play on the same idea that we find later. And therefore, including with Sadia Gonu, relates this whole last little growth of the Karen to Islam, uses Pesha Shomim to the building of the mosque on the Mokum HaMikdash. So even though it's not a Sheketz, because it's not Avodah Zorah, but it's pesha, because anything that is destructive of the real Aveda and the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is called pesha. And that becomes now, even though Rashi relates it to the Shikut Shamim, which was the end of the Talmud, and they put up Hadrian, put up the Greek temple and Avodah Zorah and so on. But still, again, there's many mixed metaphors. That I want to stress that that's fine. In other words, the fact that we find Pirushim in this direction and that direction, even as Rashi himself does in Hazinu, and over there you're talking about Mamish, Moshe Rabbeinu's poetry, his poetic vision of the future. And Rashi brings half of the Pirush Kodi Wamandi Armor in the Sifri, and half of the Pirush Kodi Wamandi Armor in the Sifri, and he asks on himself, right? He says, look, the whole thing is meant to be understood as a multi-leveled poem. It's not meant to be particularly consistent in one direction. Wherever you find Ramazan for it and so on, the same pattern, he actually speaks about it as patterns. Look, this is the pattern that we saw, this is the pattern that you're going to see again, and therefore I feel free to interpret various elements that you can relate to better this way than that way. The same thing is true over here. The fact that we can get a hint of one narrative and then a hint of another narrative and see these as mixing. It is great. Because sometimes an element of historical pattern comes out much more clearly at some later date and you could trace it back. And you could say, now I understand that was really linked to something that people didn't take seriously at the time. And it happens very, very often. Certainly when you're talking about something that is as broad as the Chezionot of Daniel, it's perfectly okay to have mixed metaphors. You could have elements that are describing Islam, elements that are describing Rome, elements that are describing Antiochus, and various stages of the breakup of Greece. And even though in our perception of history, these things are separated by centuries and more, That's really not a problem if you're looking at it from the point of view of patterns. You take it as poetry, so then obviously it has multi-level interpretation. You know, people do this in their own lives all the time. There's no reason why we can't do it in a chazion that's meant to be poetic. And so, again, the question over here was, how long will it be that Tate, the Vav of the Vekodesh over here, is probably Vekodesh Vitzavah, not and, but rather Vekodesh Vitzavah, putting some, that you do that sometimes in Hebrew, in which a whole mishmash of things gets put together with an indicative Vav at the beginning to say this integrated series, not as if it's a break, and, but rather Tate, the Kodesh, the Tzabah, and so on and so forth. The Tate has one object of the verb Tate, which is all the things that you understand are included and in Kodesh and Tzabah. How long will all that is meaningful and all that is holy be given over to Mirmas, to be given over just to be crushed? And therefore, it's here that Chazal take this. It's a very, very beautiful Medrash. So first of all, the Medrash says, well, who is Echad Kadosh? So, according to Amandi Omar, Echad Kadosh in the Medrash is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shema Yisrael, Shema Lekinu, Hashem Echad. And that's Kadosh. Ki HaKol Amrim Lefanav Kadosh. So that this is really a vision, and that's why the Rambam talks about it in this sense, as semi-Nevius, so to speak. And there's other Amandi Omar, but the beautiful approach over here is that Achilles was Metargim, that the, who is this Palmoni? We're saying that everything is going to be. This is Adam Arishon. That he was originally not Palmoni, he translated Pnimi, the one that was meant to be all the way inside. And that's man is meant to be all the way inside. These angels are just silly gestalts compared to a human being. And his Bechitza was meant to be Lifnimi Malachi Asharet. And therefore, when we were asking, this human beings in the situation that they were, that they are now, is absurd. So how long is this supposed to go on? Is this lo'olam hayta? What, it's supposed to be like this forever just because we had this little problem in Gan Eden? I mean, come on. This has been going on too long. Va'pesha shomein? What, so because of this sin? So now he's got to be sitting there in the grave for so many thousands of years, this is the state of humanity. Vitzavam mirmas, that humanity should be for trampling in front of a malach hamavis, a chutzpah. How long is this going to go on? And this is what is being addressed over here. So that the questions are meant for Daniel to understand that although he may be taking this very locally, the way in which the whole story is being viewed in the Shamayim is a question about the nature of humanity and how is it that this chait is ever able to be addressed? And why is it that within that nested world that exists underneath Gan Eden and that is meant to pop back out into Gan Eden, how long and how much could possibly be achieved in this length of time? Does it seem to be going anywhere? So that's it's a deeper question that removes him from all of the import of the local. Vayomer Eli, and he says to me, and this is why to say to me, because it wasn't addressed to him, it was addressed to the Malach. So again, here it's clear that since there was no way for him to be zoche to a communication on the level of Michael, so what it is that's being communicated now to the Sabbath, this the Medrash speaks out that this one is Michael, the other is Gavriel, that the one who speaks to him and translates the words for him is Gavriel. So Vayomer Eli, Ad erev boker alpayim ushlosh meot vinitzdak kodesh. Until nightfall and morning, 2,300, and then the things that were meant to be holy will end up being justified. And we wait till tomorrow on this one. So the Vayomer, once again, there seems to be some lack of clarity about the Vayomer. What happened over here is that there was a general description of all of this chazon that Daniel wasn't picking up and that he sensed was there, but that he wasn't understanding. And this was coming from the vision that he had of this malach, he just knew was speaking, but that he was not able to actually see. So there was no gestalt that was available to him. So then that palmoni, that was the vision of the Adam, who's the Pnimiyas, Chazal say, in which a malach is taking the place of Adam HaRishon. So now this someone speaks. And it turns out that this someone is Gabriel, as we'll see. He's speaking to this source of information that has been giving Daniel all of this information. And Lamais, according to Ibn Ezra, the words that appear to be talking about things that are not visible, the Atzar HaTzavahi Gdil, Uimenu Huram HaTamid, those are not words that he could have seen. Those are only words he could have heard. What image lies behind these words? There's no image. Huram HaTamid, Ushlach B'chol Mikdasho, it's not that he actually sees this, I see this. It just says, V'tigdal HaTzavah HaShemayim. So apparently, these words were coming from somewhere, and he knew that they're coming from somewhere. And this is the palmoni that's being medabere-like. And the someone now who speaks to him, who is Gabriel, who now speaks to me, where over there, I hear him addressing this palmoni on two levels. First of all, he addresses him as the source of the information, the chazon that was given to Daniel up until this point. But secondly, according to the Medrash, he addresses him as a vision of Adam HaRishon and the human condition that has been destroyed. In great detail, every one of the words of the Pasuk is understood by the Medrash as referring to some element of the human condition. He's being given over to death, he's being mirmas in front of a malach, that we call the malach HaMavet, which makes no sense, and which was not what things are supposed to be. And obviously, in some way, we're going to see this becomes very significant later today. So just keep in mind that the palmoni has a double identity. So he's just this very hidden one, kasi, tamir, as the Targum learns it, hidden and unidentifiable. So if I don't understand the vision of a gestalt, I can't give it a name. It's just something mysterious. And on the other hand, we're in Chet Yud Gimel. On the other hand, it also is the description of that malach that clearly must have been the source of words that he was picking up, but that weren't at all clear to him because they were only words and weren't attached to a face that he could identify. So he hears now one of these kedoshim, which is a malach, speaking now and asking, Ad matai hachazon hatamid vapesha shomeim? How long is this going to be? That the impact of Pesha on the Talmid should last around, and this Shomeim should be put there to give, referring, as we said yesterday, to all of the things that have taken over the Harabayit and the Mabgam Mikdash, which begins with the Hadrianus Avodah Zarah, where it's called Shikutz, we see later on, and then given an overall sense of Pesha, even if it's not a Shikutz, in attempting to take away the Mabgam Mikdash from its real function. We see this related earlier to the breaking of the Seder HaKorbanos. We saw how that related also even to the earlier, those who want to learn that it has to do with Antiochus, it really does go directly from that period and all the impact of that period into the invitation to the Romans that end up making it permanent. So that even though there was only a period in which there was Usara Tamid, and those were the last 6 years, even though it's not given a clear-cut identity, the Cheshbonos that we're going to see later assume 6 years, which is less than a Shavua. So it's Chetzi Shavua, as it's called. Anything less than a Shavua. And that period, even though it's a very short-lived period, is seen as paradigmatic for the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash later, which is how it is that Rome and Greece become conflated here because of the ideas that are behind the destruction. So that the only one that was aimed directly against the Kochavim, against the Tzava HaShamayim, was Antiochus. And that was the beginning of Hellenization, which leads to all of the developments subsequently, not only the political, the geopolitical elements of bringing in Romans, But the actual cultural contact that led to the insanity that was going on in the early years of the Roman Empire, in which all of the women were becoming Jewish, and the idea of Christianity taking a place under the encouragement of the government in order to prevent those kind of things from going on. There was a tremendous religious revival, which Christianity capitalized on, which is why there's even, according to many, many sources, the strangest rumors, I'm sure you must have heard, that Paul was actually a shliach of the Sanhedrin and was sent specifically in order to get this craziness away from Yisrael, to start a new religion and to move it to the Goyim, because the early years of Christianity were entirely Judaic.
He was a mole?
Supposedly he was an actual mole, according to many. It's an amazing thing. And that there's all kinds of stories about it, about like what they had to promise him if he would do this, and so on.
Is that my youth?
That's
perfect.
Yeah, it is perfect. So that of, what's that?
I was told once he was the author of Shochemach.
Yes, that's right. Yes, of course. Yeah, there's a lot of very curious mysteries behind that whole period, in which the main concern was that the Romans were getting way too interested in Yisrael again, and that was like part of the whole problem originally with Yaakov and Esav, and especially among the women. I mean, the empire was absolutely inundated with requests for giur and so on, and so this was supposedly a red herring. But whatever it is, on many different levels, we can really trace the beginning of the renewed confusion of Yaakov and Esav to that period. And that's why we find in the Gemara that they understood that their period was parallel to that, which is why Rebbe insisted on writing to Antoninus in the way that Yaakov Avinu addressed Esav, and was very conscious that each element was learned from there, to the extent, as we saw back in the Gemara of Avodah, that Rome patterned their relationship with Yisrael on the drushas of the Psukim, Yavonot, and the Inifneavdo, and so on. So that means that the parallel was profoundly expressed subconsciously in the entire cultural mythos of what they were. And that's where all of the holidays which were built around the victory of Esav over Yaakov and the Gera Nasha and the Asara Rubi Malchus going back to the Inyanim of Yosef and Yavan and so on. And we'll see that this vision of the Neil here in what's called Perikhet actually makes reference to the religious and mythological roots of what happens later on and how it is that they use these things against Yisrael in terms of the church and the entire description of a supposed Judeo-Christian culture, which has been extremely damaging to Yisrael, because things that are very, very close are far more pernicious than things that are obviously and absurdly different. And this is mentioned here. And so, but what's important to remember is that there's the double meaning of taking this into the question, not only of what the issues are for Klal Yisrael, but what does this have to say about the human condition? Vayomer Eli ad erev boker alpayim u'shlosh meot v'nitzdak kodesh. Well, it's until the evening morning. And of course, evening morning doesn't make any sense. What is evening morning? I mean, it's either evening or it's morning. We find evening is not morning, when morning it's not evening. So on the level of the Midrashim that see this as a description of the human condition, so then it would mean the end of Erev and the Boker of Olam Hazeh, Abba. That is what it means, is that this human condition is built into the nature of life in a world in which there needs to be process and only process and no achievement, no final achievement. If you're looking for a change in that, it's going to have to wait until the final Erev, to the beginning of an entirely different reality. If we interpret it bipashtut, on the level of that it appears to me that he's only talking about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Hasarat HaTamid, which is where it begins, it keeps referring to the Tamid, then what we're talking about over here is the Erev of the period of the godless of Avodah Zarah and the beginning of the rebirth dawn of Geula. In any event, it's not even clear, are we talking about years, are we talking about days, are we talking about weeks, again, Machlokas in the Rishonim. According to the Ibn Ezra, who sees this as being very, very local, and a reference to the period of Antiochus and so on, he learns that these are days. It has nothing to do with the ultimate chazon, which is problematic later on, as we're going to see today, because the Malach specifically tells him that you are not meant to see this as only a local interpretation. The question is whether we're given the long-term interpretations or whether the verse drops it off in mid-verse to indicate that we're not telling you anymore, which we'll see. There's two ways of understanding that. But most of the Mefarshim learn that these are a reference to years and that Erev Boker, because of the fact, as Rashi points out, the word Erev Boker is repeated later on by the Malach and saying, pay attention to that because I really mean that. So it's clearly not meant to be taken as the words mean. And he says, therefore, it has to be a gematria. So if you add the gematria of the Erev Boker, which is 574, to the number of years that are given, the Alpaim Shlosh Meot, which is 2300, then if you understand that what we begin with is Yiridas Mitzrayim, then it ties in exactly to the number that's given later on in Perek Yud Beis, which is 1,290 years from the Bitul HaTamid. Because over here, if you add to the 1,290, you add the years of Galut Mitzrayim, and the years, the 480 years between that and the Binyan Beis HaMikdash, and the 410 years of the Beis HaMikdash, and the 70 years of Bovel, and the 420 years of the second Beis HaMikdash, minus the 6 years in which there was the Husar HaTamid, add the 1290 starting from the Husar HaTamid, and it equals 2,874, which is exactly the number that is given here. So therefore, they were very much mistamech on that. And of course, as Rashi says, but it ain't done no good, because those years have done come and gone. And the truth is, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's very interesting what he says. He says, look, I mean, the guy who's seeing all of this was told not to give enough information over that should actually be able to be utilized to make any types of predictions with. And therefore, and then there's the question is, I mean, he himself, who knows what he knew? You know, Afulo Niglam. I mean, yeah, he was, to him it was also very unclear. He keeps saying, I didn't know what was going on. And therefore, Anu Nochil Avtachat Malkeinu, Keitzach HaKeitz, we'll wait till each one of these cheshbonot come and go. Ubavor Keitz Hadoresh, when along comes a Keitz and it passes. So, fine, no dakita abim midrashav. So he made a mistake, big deal. And then the next one coming next, Abacher next, whoops, bing. The next one will come along. Yitor v'yidrosh derech acheret. Because everybody, after all, wants to say something to the local population, you know, for the next 100 years, give them something to look forward to. And, you know, who knows? And basically, we'll wait and we're batuach. In the end, Yavo HaMelech Meshichenu, Yasir Shikutz HaShomeim, and so on and so forth. We don't need to have anything more than that. And this, of course, ties into our understanding of the nature of the Neil. On the simplest level, if somebody's coming to break the paradigm of Geula, to make it go hand in hand with the vision of the Malchuyot, to understand that there's a massive human development that is part of it. It's built into the nature of Olam Hazeh. It is not simply historical. It's the actual meaning of living in this configuration of reality. And therefore, there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it. It's simply the way things are. And this was very shocking. And I will see that the truth is there are deeper meanings to Daniel himself and to what it is that Daniel serves. It's not just sort of a sop for, you know, some way in which you can get across the idea that things are not as simple as they seem. But let's first continue on what happens. So then Daniel hears all of this and sees the discussion, the answer that is given to Gavriel on his behalf, which he wouldn't have been able to ask himself, he wouldn't have been able to answer himself. So then, Vayhibir oti ani Daniel etachazon. So when I see this, that includes when I see these words, va'avakshavina, and I want to understand this. I don't think this makes any sense to me. Vine omed ledagdi kamar e gaver. And here there's something that looks like a human in front of me. But of course, Gaver is not the way we normally refer to humans. And therefore, if we recognize that Gaver and Gavriel, together with the nature of Gibor, which is Gvura, Gvura is Binas Adin, which is Daniel, all of a sudden some strange things start coming into focus. Some type of specific relationship of this Gvura gestalt as a human in the form of Daniel, or at least some element of a higher Daniel that he's able to relate to, talk to. Veshma kol Adam ben Ulai. I hear the sound of a human who is that's coming out of between the water of the Ulai River. Vayikra, and I hear him call out and say, "Hey, Gabriel, Avela Lazatamare, why don't you explain to that guy what this is all about? Because yeah, he's a good guy, basically. Halaz is a lashon of chashivut. And we're going to see later on that they like him in the Shemayim. He's a cute guy. So explain things to him. Go ahead." So he's given permission now to respond to Gavriel's request. And now he knows who he's talking to. I mean, to the deal's request. Now he understands, because the Malach is called Gavriel, that the Demut Gever is indeed somehow related to the nature of Gvura. So Vayavo Eitzel Omdi. So this vision now approaches where I am standing. Ubivo, as it approaches Nivati, I'm absolutely terrified. Ve'pla upon I collapse on my face. Vayomer Eli, and it says to me, Avein ben Adam, Gila et Ketzachazon. You have to understand something. You're not meant to be able to really appreciate what you're looking at, because we're talking about things very far off that you have no metaphors for and you have no concept of. So you're asking for Bina. That's not really possible. I'm going to try my best to let you understand something. Now, in this context, the Ben Adam is very important, because this Ben Adam becomes the entire way that Yecheskel is referred to throughout the book. And here, Chazal have pointed out that the Pnimi is the nature of humanity, which is Adam, as Moshe pointed out. That's the very fact of the Ploni Almoni, in a sense. Adam, as a species, doesn't have a name, really. It's just Ha-Adam, the human. The human represents the entire species. In that sense, it would be Pnimi and Ploni Almoni. So that the calling of Daniel Ben Adam seems to imply that his position here is to recognize that he stands in for humanity in this description. Now that gives him a completely different sense of mission and an understanding to us of what he's really all about. But let's see what happens. Ubedabro in me, as he's speaking to me, I simply gave up. I fell asleep. Nirdamti alpa my arts. I mean, I just, you know, what's the point? It's like when you're listening to something that is completely, totally out of reach, and you're completely exhausted by the effort that you're making and these things that are going on in your brain, which really drain you. I was drained. Vayigabi, he touches me and forces me to stand. He stands me up. So in other words, the point is that what we're looking at right now is not Daniel's own search for understanding. As far as he was concerned, he gave up. And in fact, we are looking at an insistence, milamala, that a Ben Adam be made aware of certain things. And he says to me, look, I'm going to tell you whether you like it or not. Hineni modiacha, I am going to tell you. Et asher yeva acharita zam. Zam, of course, the simple meaning of zam is anger. But the more profound sense of zam is the immense tumult, the tumultuousness of the changes, the storminess of things that the process cannot even be described. I can try to give you over a sense of what will happen. Now, the next words, kilomo et kates, nobody can quite understand what they're supposed to mean. They sound like the beginning of a sentence that suddenly stops. For at the time of the kates, you know, like bleep, sorry. And then and what's amazing is that indeed, he never tells him anything. All he does is give him, here in this parak, is he gives him the information about, okay, who's the ram and who is the he-goat? And I wasn't asking about that. I was asking how. So that sounds like that was the bleep. And this, of course, what he says, as to the rest, he says later, okay, make sure that it doesn't get out. Bleep. So in other words, this may be the part that was bleeped out, possibly. Unless it's simply saying, well, you should know there is a moed for the kates. But later, before, it was always called eight. So unless it's trying to say that no matter what happens, whatever appears to you to be going on, there's nothing that interferes with the fact of moed that's pre-programmed, that things fall into place. Don't worry about that. Some learn that that's all that it means, that there is a moed for the kates. Thank you. Okay. I mean, he says it in Imodiacha. How come he didn't tell him? So obviously things are missing. The question is where were they bleeped out? Now, I am.
Why can't it be simply that I'm going to tell you what's going to get into the days. There is an end. Isn't that what one of the things that you were saying? Would be partial.
That's not Asher Yeh Bachri. Asher Yeh doesn't mean there will be an end. Asher Yeh means I'm going to tell you what's going to be at the end. That can't be what I'm telling you. I'm going to tell you what's going to be at the end, an end. That's not a solution. Very strong word. Exactly. Right. Exactly. That's why we use it as a. That is the word in Hebrew for eschatology, really, that sense of kings. But getting back to the local issues, ha'ayel asher ra'ita ba'ala karnayim. So the two-horned ram, that's Malchai Madayu for us. Now, ha'tzafir ha'sa'ir. Oh, I'm sorry, I wanted to mention something. No, I'll mention it later. Okay. The ha'tzafir ha'sa'ir, that he-goat that you saw, that is the king of Yavan who's going to be the Keren Gedolah, Asher ben Yirav, who ha'melech ha'rishon, he's an amazing guy, he's going to completely take over in no time at all and fly over the earth, basically. Have everything, as Barnea mentioned yesterday, this is a man to whom Malchus means strategy, so that everything, all of the supply lines, all of the issues are very carefully strategized. The tactics are put into place before. This is the first time that Malchus functions not as responsive and reactive, but rather completely aware of what it's doing and is able to do this, in modern terms, it's a blitzkrieg kind of idea in which for years before you have planned out the impact of what you're doing and how it's going to come and the preparation for it and so on. This is Malchut on a grander scale than we saw of simply the idea of integration through representation and so on. This is the sense of the integration under a cultural vision that's meant to be absorptive, and that, of course, that's the amazing power of the Hellenization that took place. And then when you saw the Hanishberet, you saw the horn that just broke, and then you saw that there were four that took its place. Those were Arba Malchiyot Migoy Yamodna. Those were the four separate divisions of Alexander's empire. They'll stand up beneath them, but they will never again have any of that sense of what he was. That's not going to happen again. And at the end of that, again, what is Ke'atem HaPoshim, the no-goodniks? Again, the no-goodniks is that, the no-goodniks of Yisrael, who became Hellenized, and they suffered in the destructions during that period of the Maccabim, is the Poshim, meaning when the Greeks were really taken over by the Romans and turned into nothing but a satrap. And whatever it is, there will be a Melech Azpanim Umedin Chidot. So once again, is the Azpanim the nature of the Churban? Is it Vespasianus? Is it Titus? As Rashi understands, the remnants of the Romans. Is it Mevin Chidot? Which, as many of the other Mepharshim point out, is the church. Mevin Chidot means that we set up our own mythology. That we are there in order to take the Torah and to restructure it. Make it very attractive. V'yatzam Kocho, I mean, it sounds so much like the church. It became immensely powerful, but of course, not using temporal power. It was all about the spiritual power of its chidot. V'nifloot yashchit, it's incredible how destructive this thing was. Which, of course, again, is so strongly reminiscent of the idea of the growth of the church. V'itzliach v'yasa, and indeed was successful, was able to do whatever it is that it wanted. V'shchit atzumim v'am kedoshim, destroyed what you would think the most powerful governments and seats of temporal power. And worst of all, what it was that they did to Yisrael, Ramayim, Betera, and all based on religion and Sichlo, Vitzviach Mirma. He had this Alpi, his Seichel, wasn't arms, manipulation by the mind. And having much success with all of the lies, mirma biado, ubilvavo yagdil, getting so full of itself, Ubishalva, in its very peace and complacency, Yashchid Rabim will destroy so many. V'alsar Sarim Ya'amod, and then will raise its hand against HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Some learn Sar Sarim would be in the, as we say, that's the Hashem Tzivakot. Rashi understands this again to be talking about what Titus did in the Beis HaMikdash before the understanding of the others, that it's referring to the growth of the church. He understands Uba Efes Yad Yishaver, without even raising of a hand it will be broken. He understands that to be a reference to the story of Titus with the, as the Gemara says, the parasite that invaded his brain and destroyed his brain from the inside, which nobody had to do anything for. Or those who even make it more local, like the Ibn Ezra, understands this being a reference to the Antiochus issue. He, indeed, nobody knows what happened to him. It's the wildest story. I mean, the rumors are that his body started to decay while he was still alive. Nobody can go near him. And there's some kind of mysterious illness. Sounds like Ebola disease or something. And his flesh just rotted away. And that would also be the same idea. Or, of course, it might be referring to... It might be referring to much later developments. It might be referring to the Soviet Union, to communism, to the fact that there was nothing there and everything was just a Potemkin village and nonetheless was able to control so much, so many hundreds of millions, and then suddenly just disappeared without anybody raising a hand. I mean, it's again, since it's patterns, it doesn't really matter. Just remember. I think about the Erev HaBoker, and that's what Rashi says, you see. I mean, what if he has to reiterate that it's true? I mean, I understand everything he says is true. In other words, what he's trying to do is trying to say, even though it doesn't make any sense, find sense in it because it's real. I mean what I'm saying. V'atav, as far as you're concerned, sitom hachazon. Okay, don't give out any information. That's dangerous. Kileyamim rabim. I mean, the effect of understanding that we're talking about a millennia here is going to destroy people's ability to handle this. So don't say anything. And of course, Vani Daniel, Niyetim, I was completely broken from this. Minechaletim, and I got literally sick for days, Yamim. And then, Viakum Viased Melechat HaMelech. I got up because I had a job, you know. And of course, that job, some point out, includes coming to Belshazzar's party to give him the final piece of information. So some understand that to be the Eshtamim Al Amar'ed. You know, like this could have taken place 2 days later. There I am called, and oh my God, I can't believe it's starting already. I thought, you know, I know we're talking about maybe 10 years from now. Oh no, what comes next? You know, this of course enables him to understand where we're at in the story. So he said, I was shocked. But nobody could see how shocked I was. I was very good at covering up. But boy, I couldn't believe my eyes. So that's, again, that's if it's referring to that particular issue. Others learn that it's a remez to the fact that he now twisted his entire malacha to start doing a kashborfu's malacha. That's how the psik understands it. In other words, instead of concentrating on what's going to be in Babel and so on, I see it's all over. So from that point on, and we'll see that this is really what happens when he starts doing his tefillah and asking kashborfu what's going on in the next parak, we'll see that his focus changes from his job to do in Bavel to what is his role in terms of bringing about at least the Beis HaMikdash HaSheni, and how does he do the Melechat HaMelech in the midst of all of this, meaning HaMelech as Melech Malchei HaMelechim. But now, I just want to point out that there's a Havein Ben Adam. Look, you know, you're only a Ben Adam, but you're also a Ben Adam. So there's a double meaning to that. You know, you're immortal. There's not that much that you're going to be able to understand. Leit Ketzach Hazon, you're very limited in your own particular time-space line, and you can't be expected to be able to understand. But you are also a Ben Adam. Now, when he says near Damti, that's very, very fascinating, because, of course, that's exactly what happens in Gan Eden to Adam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Mapil Tardema Al Adam. It never says that he woke up from that Tardema. From that Tardema came the beginning of Da'at. That's all we're told. The Tardema falls on the Adam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him the woman. But then he woke up. And then he finds himself speaking. and seeing things in this different way in which what was once clear now becomes completely confusing. And then he's given these coats on his way out of Gan Eden, which get involved in the whole story of the Nimrod, that those are the coats that Nimrod ended up having, which was the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar ben Benoshim, Nimrod and Russia, and what's happening over here with the destruction of those who are attempting to control things in which Memshala becomes the issue. In that context, the Tardema, the Nirdamti, and being called Ben Adam, asking about the human condition, seem to become even more powerful. If that's the case, and we recall that at the end of the book, Daniel is put to bed in a very strange way, in which, like the last words that we hear about him, is that, look, these things will be okay, but it's for you, Lech Lakeitz, go to the end, V'tanuach, why don't you go to sleep for a while, maybe like a few thousand years. And that's goodbye, Daniel. And then V'tamod v'garolcha Lakeitz Hayamin. That is a very powerful closure of all of these things, because what's the difference? I mean, everybody dies. What are you telling him? Go to sleep for a few thousand years. I mean, you can say that about anybody who dies. If the point is, though, that Daniel is meant to be the Ben Adam at the moment of asking about, in detail, the nature of the human condition as we experience it by Olam Hazeh, then Daniel himself as a Gavriel expression in the world of Din is himself as a human similar to the nature of the Leviathan in my Sabratius. Because it means that it's necessary to have an accompaniment through this period in which it's clear that there is a vision. It doesn't matter whether you get the vision. In other words, it's very similar to the kind of amazement that people felt when they discovered for the first time species that had been thought to be extinct for 100 million years, you know, the various fish that were discovered all of a sudden at unbelievable ocean depths and so on, which is similar to the idea of the Leviathan. The sense that early geological history is still with you. The place where this is brought out in terms of the mitzvahs, according to Chazal, is amazing. It's tzitzis. The concept of the tzitzis is just so astonishing, because what it means is you take a marine, very, very early on in evolutionary history animal that is extremely primitive. You utilize it on the rare occasions when it's exposed to the sun. An excretion that serves to escape from its enemies in the water, which is black, turns this beautiful color in sunlight. But it's the color of the Kisei HaKovod that's Meramis to the Shamayim. And you take that, and that becomes the simen of Malchus, the royal purple all over the world. I mean, it's so much so that the Romans absolutely prohibit anybody who's not nobility to wear it. Penalty of death to wear this thing. Complete control of the Tchelet's trade. I mean, it's like a crazy thing, royal purple. That idea of linking the beginning to the end, which is the ultimate expression of Malchus, is being Tchelet, of course, is the same word for Tachlit. It means end, the complete end of things, right? And that's why the Ramban points out, that's why it's usher to wear your tzitzis out, because that way the Tchelet itself is extremely dangerous. Because what Tchelet implies, al pi Kabbalah, is self-organization to such an extent that you lose any sense of where it came from. It's so amazingly powerful, the thought of the interrelationship between those two things, that the Ramban explains, Volotaturu achrei nechem, means that looking at the Tchelet can lead you away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because the power of self-organization is overwhelming. And you don't see, it's like the childishness of people like Hawking's in his new book, or of Dawkins and so on. People do not understand, because of the mechanical orientation, that not only do they not distance God by pointing out that you don't need a creator to put together tinker toys, because that's all that they're showing, but that you actually come to the lowest primal levels of the nature of what it is to exist, which becomes the root of all of the various complexities that you see around you. And here too, if you're just that one little piece is missing in Western civilization, it's totally missing because people don't have words for it. In the East, it's very clear In the West, the English doesn't allow you to recognize that transition, which is why science never made the transition. They keep looking for a theory of everything that's mechanical, which is never sufficiently a theory of everything anyway, because it's always going to be expressive of something that underlies patterns in the world and so on. But here, that would mean that the Neil, the presence of the Neil, just like the Leviathan means there is Livui. Livui simply means there's something that is there in a line from beginning to end. That doesn't need to change. That doesn't need to develop. It's almost as if I compared it once to the idea of they had these massive building projects. What they'll always do is they'll make a model, and they'll have it available for the public to look at. It's going to take 30 years until this is finished. But if you know that there's a model there, and you get a sense of where it's going, now, so at least you don't think this is insane. What are they? You know, it's like what you used to feel about Mamila Mall, you know, where every day some other building was coming down and the opposite building was going. It's like somebody lost their mind. That's literally what it looked like. So they were walking and working on Rehov Yafo, you know. One day it's like 40 feet lower, the next day it's 60 feet higher. I mean, what is it? Do they know what they're doing? If they had only put a model, then at least there would have been a little bit of confidence that there's something. The Leviathan is that model. And Daniel, he's not expected to understand. I'm going to be able to explain to you the end. You'll look at the model. So now you understand why today we had to go down 40 feet tomorrow. You don't understand. Except that you recognize, okay, somebody must know what they're doing. So if Daniel is a stand-in for humanity, and he's told, okay, now you can go to sleep and wake up if you want to see the end of the story. So then that indeed gives you a line in which, okay, at least I could sleep easy now, knowing that somebody knows what's going on. Because it sure looks completely and hopelessly chaotic from the point of view of these images of Nebuchadnezzar. So then he really serves a purpose far more than just giving over the sense that things are different. He's also gives over a feeling of willingness to be part of the process because of the fact that I could see it as an enterprise and not just crazy, disattached events that follow one another with complete, no real cause and effect, no understanding. By the way, that's stressed again and again. And then he just disappears. Then well, what is that supposed to mean? How do you relate to the fact that Alexander just disappears? Is it part of the story of Greece? Is it built in? It's all an accident? One 25-year-old guy? That's what it's all about? The whole world? It leaves you feeling completely as if it's a Daniel. That's ridiculous. How can the world be dependent on the heartbeat of a kid? That doesn't make sense. So that much is what he can give us.
Interesting, this idea you're just talking about, the Leviathan and Daniel and line two, seems to be complementary to the Atikyamin that we talked about before.
Yes, very, right. Very much.
The Atikyamin shows that the Kav goes through,
the Kav,
and here's the human counterpoint.
Yes, but it all ties into that nature of Tikva, Kav, Livui, and Chakelo, and so on. And again, I don't think these are not far-fetched feelings, because people have exactly the same feelings. I mean, those few people understand the value of the enterprise of understanding the nature of reality. Somebody who's dedicated his life to science and to discovery that is very at peace with the fact that the enterprise goes on. It doesn't see it as needing to be there from beginning to end. You are there from beginning to end. Because you understand that it's such a joint enterprise. It's such an achievement of what it means to have been here in the world that the fact that this may be my small contribution, that's not important. It's not the size of the contribution. It's having lived this enterprise. That is all that needed to be. So that exactly what happens to Daniel. You don't have to worry about what's going to happen. And that's what we say to everyone. Lo alech ha-melacha ligmor. But you need to know, and that's the melacha, is the word that it uses here. The melech ha-melach calls, exactly the same thing. It says, lo alech ha-melacha ligmor. You just have to know that you really and truly are a contributing member to this immense thing. And I think human beings are well aware of that, of the ability to fight these wars, to be engaged in this historical development. means that the simplest people, when put into positions in which they understand the massive power of the flow of history, and they understand that they're just cannon fodder and that they're playing this tiny role, nonetheless, there is the sense of courage and grandeur and majesty that's associated with what they're doing, because they feel that it's meaningful and real.
But the average Joe,
he does have that. Put him into position. Now you look back.
He's looking in from the outside.
You look ahead.
Does he get it?
Yes, he gets it in terms of his behavior. Yes, at one point he gets it. And that's what it is that people take seriously about a Congressional Medal of Honor. You know, come on. I mean, he was just in a position where,
What was he thinking?
You know, The Greatest Generation, or the feeling that, wow, how did just regular people, how they pull this off? You know,
That's just it. That's what I mean. The average Joe just walking down the street doesn't really get it. He's looking for the close of the episode.
Yeah, no, but that's because
until
that's exactly the point. And this, the Neil represents that until all the time. So just as we have our heroes, and that provides a certain level, as Hanukkah did, a certain level of the grandeur of the heroic journey that we're on, the Neo is meant to supply the sense of the human awareness and concern more for the journey than for the personal closure. That's a very big change.
This is the confusion, the conflict, the indecision between waiting for something to happen because it's going to happen anyway with Purim versus taking control, taking action, kind of where
that's a book that's coming out.